This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the BPOS podcast. I am here with my good friend Mike Thompson. Man, I am so excited to have you here because it's always great to hang out with you.
It's been a long time coming, I feel like. This is just going to be a conversation between us like we're having coffee like normal.
That's exactly right.
We've been doing
right.
that for 15 years now.
Coffee, tacos,
yeah,
all the goods.
Yeah, that's how we roll.
Yeah. You know, now that I think about it, that seems to be my MO with most of my close friends is coffee and tacos.
Do the things that you love. I mean, obviously you're a coffee guy, so it makes sense that you would share your passion with people yep. on an everyday basis.
Yeah.
But what's better than tacos? I mean, like being born and raised in Austin, I've had access to the best breakfast tacos since, you know, 39 years of it.
Yeah.
And it brings people together like no other, I feel like. Coffee and tacos.
No shortage of great taco joints.
So good here.
On that note, did you know that we just started working with Taco Deli and they're using Cuvée at all their stores
now? I did. It's one of those partnerships that just makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's long overdue, yeah. I would even offer that to say.
I'm excited about it. Shameless plug, sorry, but shout out to Taco Deli.
Love you, Taco Deli.
All right, well, listen. Number one, thank you for giving me a copy of your book, Finding Good. The good news for me is I was just finishing up a book and I was on a trip and I was like, you know what? I'll throw this in my bag in case up. And as soon as I got on the airplane, I didn't realize I only had like 10 pages left in the book. So I devoured this, man.
Love it. Awesome.
Dude, great job.
Thank you.
Like really well written. And knowing you like I do, I mean, I could tell it was your voice.
I put a lot of work into it.
I mean, it's
like
obvious.
A few years. And really, 10 years ago, I would say, is probably when I started getting serious about writing it. And I had some close friends when I was working at the bike shop invest in it. You know, one gave me $1,000 just to, like, start putting some words on paper and start working on the design. But fast forward to, you know, 2021, 2022... After COVID, I had gotten laid off from a job that I thought I would have for many years in healthcare with a major medical system mm-hmm. that my wife also currently works for. COVID hit, you know, get laid off with 1,200 other people.
Yep.
And at that point, at that juncture, I decided, you know, I'm going to stick with school, get a master's degree in communication because I feel, I love communication and have been public speaking in some capacity since I was 13 years old.
Crazy.
And then communication is rooted in everything that we do. Every industry, every aspect of society is founded in communication. So I really wanted to understand not just the practical applications of communication, like messaging, emails, phone calls, you know, conversations, but what are the symbols? What is the purpose of your and my communication, our dialogue? And it's persuasion. You're persuading me to, you know, continue to be a friend. You're persuading me to like Cuvée coffee. You're persuading me, you know, we're constantly persuading each other. And it doesn't have to be this completely selfish endeavor, persuasion. But persuasion, I think, is what guides us to do everything in life. And that is efforted by communication. So the book is kind of like this. Yes, it's my story. And yes, it's this kind of all-encompassing journey of being a born and raised Austinite, enduring cancer, enduring addiction, and figuring out how to live life in a prosperous way on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I leave those three tenets with everyone. But really, this is just my method of communicating with the world around me that, like, hey, you have autonomy, you have choices, you have the ability to change your attitude and your behaviors to make your life well-lived.
Yeah.
So that's what I hope people resonate. It resonates with people when they read the book. It's like, these are tools that anyone can use.
Yeah. I mean, it has to.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has to. It's really funny because I'm trying to remember what year it was, but it was when you worked at Livestrong.
Yep.
And we opened Cuvée on East 6th, and you came over and asked for a sponsorship for, you know, some bike ride or, you know, whatever it was. And that was the first time I met you. And
I think it was Bike to Work Day.
Okay.
Yeah.
What year was that? Do you have any idea?
It had to be 2014 or 2015.
So I thought.
Yeah.
So I've known you since then, and it's really, it's fascinating to me because I know bits and pieces of your story,
sure.
But we've never really like sat down and had a deep discussion about it or anything. But then when I read the book, I was like, holy shit. Like, you have been through a ton,
yeah.
A ton. And, you know, it's really, I think one of the reasons, you know, when I started this podcast, it really revolved around, the grief surrounding death, right? But the more people I talk to, you know, I start to realize that there's a lot of grief around traumatic things that happen in your life. And, you know, so I've really started to latch on to this idea that the podcast is about grief, trauma, and triumph. And I literally just that. So the message I sent you, that's the first time I ever used it. And I couldn't think of a better person to have to kind of walk through that process.
Selfishly, I agree, because not only have I lost people, we have lost people. And obviously, you know, it starts with Connor for me. And I write about him in the book just briefly of like, we never know when our time is going to be up. And that's why it's important to live life fully and wholly when we know we have it. That said, I've experienced personal grief from myself of saying goodbye to what I thought I would be.
Yeah.
I thought I would be a father. Cancer took that from me. Now, obviously, Kendall and I can adopt one day if we're called to do that, if it sounds like something that would make our family whole. But we love our dog, Dash. We have the freedom to travel anytime we want. So it's always looking at the positive, BPOS side of life. But I struggled for a long time with reconciling, you know, saying goodbye to my old self.
Mm-hmm.
The professional baseball player, the astronaut, the fighter pilot. I had, you know, childhood endeavors of making it through the military. I wanted to be a naval aviator, Top
nice.
Gun,
yep.
As any kid that saw Top Gun when they were younger.
That's why I joined the Navy.
It inspires you to give back and be part of something bigger than yourself. But cancer had a different plan for me. So from age 10 to 14, you know, 4 cancers, 3 leukemia, 1 tumor in my jaw, almost 90 surgeries total, 2 bone marrow transplants, 12 and a half hour facial reconstruction.
90 surgeries in 4
mm-hmm.
years?
Mm-hmm. 5 years, yeah. And a lot of them were to clean out a fungal infection in my nose that nearly killed me, you know, less than a year after I got diagnosed in 1995. And then every other complication that you can think of, whether it was infections, whether it was graft versus host disease, fighting, you know, the transplant, my body literally revolting and not wanting to assimilate to these new cells that were coming in. And multiple times I got told, you know, 20% chance at living, 15% chance at living, less than 50% chance at living. Certainly, when the relapses happened, it was, you know, likely you're not going to make it to adulthood.
Yeah.
I turned 39 a week ago, or 2 weeks ago now. And I love it. I'm so crazy happy, but I also have a relentless desire to get people to live whole now.
Yeah.
And I truly believe Connor did that. You know, he was obviously left this world far too soon, but he lived with vigor and passion, and that smile just exudes wholeness. And so, you know, Connor and my friend Kelly and Ashley and Billy and like all the kids that I lost to cancer when I was young, to, you know, saying goodbye to my Aunt Carolyn last week, we know that life is going to end
yeah.
for all of us. None of us are going to make it out alive.
Nope.
But what are we going to do in that dash, that time between we're born and when we eventually pass on?
Mm-hmm.
And I can think of nothing better than BPOS. You know, it's the guiding light of like, yes, we're going to experience grief. We're going to experience trauma, but we can also experience triumph.
Yep.
And I think that is such a great way to look at life.
That's awesome. Well, let's go ahead and, I mean, let's just kind of start at the start. You get diagnosed with cancer when you're 10 years old?
Yep. 10 years old in the heart of soccer season, October of 1995. I still consider myself, you know, an athlete, but mm-hmm. I was very good for, you know, having been a youth under 11 athlete.
Yeah.
And I stuck with that even through all the cancers. So baseball and soccer were my main sports.
Okay.
It was soccer season 1995, and I started to have some viral symptoms, fever, nausea, vomiting, and we ruled out the flu, we ruled out strep, we ruled out all of the obvious things that a, you know, 10-year-old boy could have.
Right.
And eventually they did more extensive blood work and found that I, you know, had some abnormal white cell activity, ended up getting diagnosed with AML, acute myeloid leukemia, M4EO, which I'm not even going to try to say it off the top of my head, but okay. It's a very rare form, an adult form of cancer in kids, and already right out of the gate, we're facing odds that aren't good. And so, as luck would have it, Friday the 13th, October of 1995, I'm admitted, don't leave the hospital for 5 months. Fungal infection sets in, almost kills me. It was Aspergillus, which is the second deadliest fungal infection that one can have.
Wow.
And, you know, my counts are bottomed out, and I had two surgeries a day for 2 weeks, clearing out my nasal cavity, taking out my sinuses, my septum, my turbinates, all that, just to clear out the infection. And in between those two surgeries, I was in the hyperbaric chamber for an hour. And you're a 10-year-old kid. Like, all I wanted to do was be on the soccer field.
Yeah.
All I wanted to do was be with my friends. And yet, literally, I was fighting to stay alive.
Yeah.
And other kids that I knew were either passing away or their families were falling into a little bit more of a desperate time.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, everything kind of shuts down. And I'm like, I don't want that to happen. Like, I'm going to fight as hard as I can. And that's not to suggest that other families and other kids that, you know, passed away were not capable of it.
Sure.
But I knew I was going to do whatever I could to stay alive. So after that, you know, February of 96, I go into remission. I have a make-a-wish. I went to go see Space Shuttle Columbia launch in Cape Canaveral, Florida.
Wow.
All other kids wanted to do Mickey Mouse, Disney, all that. And
right.
I kind of asked, like, can I do something different? And they're like, yeah, what do you want to do? Like, most 10-year-old kids are, like, okay with Disney. So I drew a picture of the space shuttle at the vehicle assembly building. I had watched this documentary called The Dream is Alive, like, dozens of times. And it was showing the space shuttle's journey into space, capturing all these different exercises that they were doing, whether it was, like, putting out a photo or a sailing array of solar panels to, like, generate energy or fixing satellites. And I thought, that's what I want to do when I get older. When I beat cancer, I'm going to be an astronaut.
Right.
And then a pilot. And went on the Make-A-Wish, had an amazing time, spent 4 days at Universal Studios riding all the rides, seeing
right.
all the attractions, got back, got tested, cancer's back. And at that point, I kind of started thinking, like, I'm really glad that I did that Make-A-Wish, because that may have been my last experience on Earth. Because relapsing meant, okay, we can try a bone marrow transplant, but relapsing is not a good sign in general, because it shows the veracity of the disease.
Sure.
Find 32 perfect matches for bone marrow. They select one. September of 96, I undergo my first bone marrow transplant after 4 days of chemo and total body radiation.
Mm.
And Mike, when I tell you that I wouldn't wish this upon anyone, I truly mean it. Right after the transplant, when my body started rejecting the new marrow, I developed a 107.1 fever. I was vomiting pieces of tissue from my esophagus and taking a swab and literally pulling out tissue from my mouth.
Mm.
The radiation and the chemo were so toxic that my body's cells were literally dying, and I was having to clear out those things. And that night when the fever hit, I started having a seizure. And I remember my mom, like, you know, grabbing my hand like this. And she remembers saying, like, you're so hot. Like, your body is just emanating heat. But I was freezing. You know, like, picture yourself having a fever that high. And I remember, like, she grabbed my hand like this. And I didn't let go of her hand because my body was seizing.
Yeah.
And she goes, just try and calm down. Try and calm down. And I, the first time I ever swore directly at my mom, I go, I can't. God damn it. She started sobbing, matched my tears, and we thought that that was it. It was 3 months in the hospital in isolation after that. The marrow finally started to take. Fast forward, 14 months later, relapse again. Luckily, they had marrow saved from the first one, and I think in life, there's you have these experiences that you kind of relive that you hope you never had again, like getting in a car wreck, having to go renew your license at the DMV, like these random things, right? Like right. Stuff that you don't want to repeat. Having another bone marrow transplant was devastating to me.
I bet, man.
I wasn't going to give up and die, but I'm like, how many more times do we have to do this to prove that I want to live? Go through another transplant. This one was half as bad as the first. So about 6 weeks in isolation, not as bad mouth sores. The nausea wasn't as bad. No seizures, very low fevers. I'm like, this is it. I beat it, you know? Get back home, get ready to go to my first year in high school, freshman at Anderson High School, and I go up to visit my bone marrow donor, Steve. And we spend, he's in Chicago, my aunts are from Chicago, my dad was born and raised there, so it's a family reunion of sorts.
Yeah.
And I'm excited because I'm going to be a high school kid. Things are returning back to normal. Baseball practice, take a ball to the jaw. It hurts more than it should. We start looking at x-rays. There's a mass forming right here.
From the trauma of the ball?
From the radiation from my first bone marrow transplant. And if I hadn't taken a ground ball to the face and started feeling where the tumor was, it may have metastasized before we could have gotten it.
Wow.
So relapse again, this time a new cancer, osteosarcoma of the mandible, that the doctors believe was likely caused by radiation from my first bone marrow transplant, right. Which just sucks because yep. It was meant to rid my body of bad cells, not create new bad cells.
Yeah.
So at this point, we see specialists. This is the holiday season of 1999. My mom and all of her mother's intuition and wisdom decided that we didn't want to go from the inside of my mouth and scoop it out. She wanted a full margin. So that meant complete reconstruction of my jaw. So in order to do that, you need to borrow a bone from another part of your body.
Okay.
And it was either a rib, piece of the hip, or a fibula. My mom, again, was like, take it from as far away from the vital organs as you can.
Oh.
So we decided on the fibula, which meant for me, no more competitive baseball, no more competitive soccer. Like, my sports identity is now done.
Wow.
And that was the beginning of my grief, saying goodbye to the self that I believed I could be.
Yeah.
And at that point, everything boiled down to me living, me beating cancer, being on the other side of survivorship. And so March 16th of 2000, I underwent the 12 and a half hour facial reconstruction, took about almost 3 hours to extract the tumor, and then the additional almost 10 to pull out the entirety of my lower mandible from just below my right ear to the left side of my chin. And then they used the fibula from my left leg to reconstruct that with a metal plate, kind of looks like a bicycle chain underneath the x-ray. It looks really cool.
Yeah.
And they got enough margin, but 2 weeks after the surgery, I developed an infection, which could have jeopardized the whole thing. And I want to talk about this part because it is in the book. It's what I open with in the preface. But it was a time that I really, really wished I was dead.
Yeah.
2 weeks after the big reconstruction, I start to smell this, like, really rancid smell coming from my mouth. Now, granted, my jaw was wired shut. I had a tracheotomy. I had a drainage tube coming out of my neck here. I had a catheter down below mm-hmm. so I could go to the bathroom.
Yep.
I had my left leg in a sling. They had not only taken the fibula out, but a big piece of tissue that's now my gum.
Oh.
Which, by the way, listeners, I know this is kind of weird. Sorry for the cringe value, but I grow hair in my mouth. Because it's the tissue from my leg.
Oh my God.
And I tell you, I got like a few free meals after I came back to life because I'm like, eating Chili's boneless buffalo wings. I'm like, oh, there's a hair in my food. And it kind of looks like a pube, like short leg hair, right?
Oh, man.
So anyways, they didn't warn me about that, but I'm about to undergo a procedure to remove the infection and take out two more teeth down here.
Oh, boy.
And because of the fragile nature of my body, being in a healing state and being, you know, just riddled with wires and tubes and everything, they wanted to just sedate me, not put me completely out. So right. Give me a cocktail of Demerol, morphine, and Versed, and I fall asleep. Now, the goal was obviously to extract and get rid of the infection, but another challenge for me was I had a feeding tube going up into my nose, down into my stomach.
Okay.
And it was so annoying. Felt like I had a hock a loogie all the time.
Yeah.
And whenever they would give me Pedialyte or Ensure, it was cold. So I could feel it going down, and it just made my throat hurt all the time. So they're going to put a stomach tube directly into my stomach. And to do that, you need to inflate the stomach. I woke up and thought that they were done with the surgery, and they weren't. They had done everything that they needed to do here with my jaw, but they were just beginning to inflate my stomach to put the feeding tube in. But because I had wet cloth over my eyes to make sure my eyes didn't dry out from all the tears I had been crying,
right,
to make sure I didn't interfere with the procedure, I was shackled down, like handcuffed to the bed, and my jaw was wired shut. So the only thing I could do was muster up kind of a muted scream.
Yep.
They had already started to insert the feeding tube directly into my stomach when I woke up. And I remember hyperventilating. I remember because I had not fasted, you know, they kept giving me Pedialyte and Ensure because they weren't putting me out completely. You know, your body shuts down whenever you have anesthesia. The choking hazard is why you fast. You don't want to have stuff come up when your body's not able to respond.
Okay.
And so I didn't fast. And so all this Ensure, this, you know, white milky substance starts to come up into my esophagus as I start to get nauseous.
And your jaw's wired shut.
Yes. And I throw up and it's coming out of my nose and it's coming out of the trach. And I'm still laying down, you know, in the prone position. And I remember they hit me with more cocktail.
Yep.
And I remember waking up 3 days later and, you know, there's this little white tablet that says, you know, what meds I'm on. And at the bottom of it are those emojis that are like, you know, left side is smiley face, right side is frown. And I take a line and I cross them out and I write, just let it kill me.
Mm.
I was done at that point. I couldn't fight anymore. My body was weak. I had atrophied after 4 years, almost five, of being in the hospital bed, had not returned to a level of sports that I wanted, had fallen behind in school. It was supposed to be my freshman year in high school, and here I am literally fighting for my life once again.
Yeah.
My mom, again, in all of her wisdom, had one little trick up her sleeve to get me to keep fighting. And two, actually. The first one was, I was in labor with you for 24 hours. You're not going to give up on me that quick. But the second one was she had this crate that she put on the foot of my bed. And, you know, again, I can barely move.
Yeah.
But she puts this down and she takes a colorful piece of paper from that bin and she reads it. And it's a letter from one of my fellow students at Anderson High School, somebody that I had gone to school with for 10 years prior. And it was 700 letters, all like that, that my fellow classmates and people at Anderson had written for me. And she said, I want you to live.
Yeah.
And all these people want you to live, but you also have to want to live. And that was the very beginning of my identification of being positively selfish. Like, I have to want to be alive. Yeah. I have to want to create a life after cancer. And it started this whole lifestyle for me ever since then. From that day, March 30th, of 2016, or sorry, 2000, 2 weeks after the March 16th racial reconstruction, I said, I'm gonna keep fighting. I'm gonna get back from this. And that was it, man. I mean, like, it was an arduous process getting the strength of my leg back.
Mm-hmm.
My jaw was, you know, inflated and swollen for a good 6 months after the reconstruction, but slowly I started to heal. And then the last real challenge of, you know, living a positive life came in the form of addiction. I had
Before we get into that, let's, because I don't want to I don't want to gloss over the importance of, and you go into detail into the book of what your mom did.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I just can't even, I can't imagine, you know, realizing that physically you're just never going to be the same. You'll never be able to achieve any of the goals or dreams that you had.
Right.
And then that transition into what that does to you emotionally, and, you know, to go through everything you went through for this extended period of time, you know, with hope, but then to hit that bottom that, like, you know what, there's no hope left. It's hopeless. And to have somebody like your mom, and of course your mom, you know, you expect your mom to, you know, fight
right
for you
right
no matter what. You know, even if you're getting attacked by a bear, your mom is going to jump
She's
in.
She's going to kill the bear.
Yes, exactly.
but to
have, and look, I think the reason it's important is, dude, imagine the shit that she was going through watching, you know, the person that she brought into the world that, you know, one of her missions in life is to protect and care for, and she can't do anything.
The impact that cancer has on a family should be talked about more. The processes that my mom had to endure of, like, being with me 5 days a week and then getting a break on the weekends to go home
yeah.
and, like, actually sleep and rest and wash clothes. Not every kid had that.
Right.
And I recognize how privileged we were to have my dad be the sole breadwinner while my mom stayed with me every single day.
Yeah.
And she went through shit. I mean, to be very candid. And sometimes it was comical and kind of funny. Like, she would, one day we were in the transplant room at Fort Worth, Cook Children's Hospital in Fort Worth, and she loved Boston baked beans, the candy. And she had a headache, so she's like, I'm going to take a couple Advil. Well, because she was so tired, she was eating baked beans. She takes the Advil, she starts chewing them up like they're tablets.
Right.
I don't know if any of y'all have ever chewed.
I have never.
Just
no.
Advil straight
imagine.
Up. It is the most bitter, horrible,
yeah.
literally mouth-numbing ordeal. And so she's getting sick to her stomach, and I'm kind of laughing a little bit. It provided a little bit of levity.
Yeah.
But I had nurses waiting on me hand and foot. If I was in pain, somebody was giving me morphine or you know, Vicodin immediately.
Yeah.
My mom didn't have that. You know, she was waiting on me. She was dumping my urinal out. She was going to get the nurse or the doctor if some complication was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I think about my dad. I think about my sisters. My middle sister, Amanda, she's 4 years my elder, was on her senior class trip to Europe when I was undergoing my facial reconstruction.
Mm.
And back then, 2000, they had calling cards. You know, this wasn't,
right.
you know, cell phones were just starting to come out, and we certainly didn't have them.
Yep.
And I remember she used up all of her calling cards trying to call home just to make sure I was still alive.
Yeah.
And that I made it through the surgery. So put that into 5 years, you know, for my mom, dad, and siblings, and really all of our friends that, you know, were kind of watching this unfold. Like, is he going to make it? Is he going to beat it? And I write about it in the book, but I need to stress, I would not be here today if it weren't for my family.
Yeah.
And certainly the idea of life after cancer started with my mom, but she also became the vehicle of delivering that messaging from my fellow students, people at my church, people at my school, people on my teams that I played on.
Mm-hmm.
She was that vehicle to get me to understand that not, you know, most people that we know were rooting for me to make it through. Everyone
awesome.
Was.
Yep.
And so I'm really glad that we touched on that, because my mom is still, to this day, the strongest person I know. She's 5 feet tall and cute as a button. She's in Alaska right now with my stepdad, Charles, and they're living their best life in retirement.
Oh,
and
cool.
I'm so glad that she can finally do what she wants and not be controlled by this disease that tried to kill us.
Yep.
And so it, perfect segue into what happened next with the addiction.
Yeah.
I had, you know, gone into age 16, 17, 18, started driving on my own, having a little bit of freedom. And we were all excited about that. And one of the freedoms meant me going to and from MD Anderson to, you know, manage my pain. And first it started out with 120 pills per month. You know, I'd take, you know, three a day or something like that, four a day. And the more I took the pills, the more I needed to help with the pain and discomfort. And to this day, I still have legitimate pain in my jaw. You know, all these nerves are crossed over. If I haven't, you know, if I've talked a lot or if I've been on a bike ride and had a lot of sugar, it gets really inflamed, especially the tissue down here underneath my fake teeth. So I still deal with chronic pain. Thankfully, I have access to medical cannabis now. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But I recall very distinctly talking to doctors and saying, you know, I feel like I'm becoming addicted to this, but I have legitimate pain.
Yeah.
And they would ask, well, is it working? I'm like, yeah, so here you go. So I got to the point, wow, Mike, where I was taking 10 Norco a day. So those are 10 milligram hydrocodone tablets, 325 Tylenol. That is the max a person that's 300 pounds and 6'5" would take. And I was taking 10 of those a day. I was taking 6 gabapentin, typically a Xanax or some sort of, you know, antidepressant drug. And then I had oxycodone. I usually had 60 a month. And so I was from 2002 until mid-2008, I was drugged up the entire time. And really since 1995, not a day had gone by that I wasn't either in the hospital fighting for my life or fighting through the struggles of addiction.
Yeah.
And it, once again, mom came through. I had gone on a mission trip to Mexico. I had come back, and while I was gone, she was cleaning out her apartment where I had been sleeping on her couch. And she opened up this drawer in this little bin that I had, and there were literally dozens of empty pill bottles. And I kept them because if I turned in the receipts, we got reimbursed because it was all bone marrow transplant related.
Okay.
I had a bone marrow transplant with radiation. The radiation caused the tumor caused the pain. So all of that I could submit for reimbursement for receipts. And I wasn't trying to hide anything.
Right.
And my mom, when I got home from the mission trip, she woke up the next morning and said, I had no idea you were in this much pain.
Yeah.
And I expressed to her that, yeah, I have pain and it is legitimate. But I couldn't get past a day or two without taking the meds because it made me feel horrible. And I'm thinking, this is how I felt undergoing chemo. So this must be how life feels after cancer. When I don't take the pills, I have cold sweats. I have diarrhea. I have low-grade fevers. I can't sleep at night. I get chills. I have bad dreams. All of that was related to the addiction, but all of it made me feel like it was just connected to the cancer and that this is how I'm going to feel post-cancer.
So then obviously you had pain. You were experiencing pain, but
right,
it sounds like if you didn't take it, it was more the withdrawal.
Correct.
Than the pain.
Right. And I knew nothing about withdrawal.
Wow.
You know, I had not ever considered like, oh, I'm a drug addict now. And as luck would have it, again, because it was transplant related, my mom found a place near Kerrville, Texas, which we briefly talked about.
Yep.
And it was called Starlight, and it was a rehab center. And I got placed in this like professional building for people that were there voluntarily.
Okay.
So we had like that kind of cohort. And then the majority of the people, 80% or so, which there were probably 300 people there when I arrived, were all there under court order or their families had, you know,
right,
noticed that their life had become unmanageable. And they were there voluntarily, but they were also like told you need to be here.
Yeah.
And I learned about both sides, like the uncontrollable, more crime nuanced side of things,
okay,
the less than reputable drug trade happening.
Right.
But then I also learned the stories of doctors and nurses and lawyers and cops and firefighters and former military who had been nursing some sort of discomfort,
yeah,
who had been, whether it was PTSD, whether it was chronic pain, they had all fallen down the path of addiction or alcoholism because that provided comfort for them. And so for the first time, I realized like none of this was really my fault and I could overcome it. As long as I got far enough away from the withdrawals and I could tell myself or I could have people tell me that I would feel good again one day without taking these drugs, then that was my new goal.
Yep.
And so 2-3 weeks after I'm in the rehab facility, I'm starting to feel feelings that I don't think I had ever felt before.
Feelings,
because
like emotional or
yeah,
physical?
Emotional, just like,
yeah,
you know, happiness and contentment. And like, yeah, there was, you know, sadness and grief, mm-hmm, saying goodbye to my old self. But I felt happy for the first time. And if you think about it, I hadn't even gone through puberty yet when I started fighting cancer. So I had to grow up really fast.
Yeah.
So here I am in my, you know, early 20s, far distant from cancer, just getting away from drug addiction. And I'm like, life is good. Like, you know, and it was 2008. So while everyone else had lost, you know, 401ks and the housing crisis was setting in, I was just starting my life. So I was kind of like I was starting with everyone else. Didn't have a savings account, didn't have a job, was floating around couch to couch with friends. And the idea that life was possible after that was never even a consideration for me until my mom intervened and said, I think you can live a different life.
Yeah.
And so I went from taking all those meds every day to literally taking nothing. The first week was horrible. I was in the bathroom every 5 minutes, literally just, you know, diarrhea, shitting out bile, cold sweats, couldn't sleep. I just very distinctly remember this is what chemo feels like. And I was right back in it. Second week, you know, some improvements. Third week, great improvements. Fourth week, I was in the gym every day. I was orchestrating basketball or volleyball games. When we had family visit, you know, I was always the one that was like bringing people together and introducing all of our friends. Yeah, I think you know by now that I'm tend to be a little bit more loquacious than most. But it became a source of celebration for me to say, cancer wasn't in my control. Addiction was.
Yep.
I beat cancer. I can beat addiction because this is on me now. And kind of to that point of, you know, writing Just Let It Kill Me and having my mom there to show me there was another way, I started to believe that I can create my own way, my own path. And, you know, we can jump into the rest of it, but that's what started my journey back to fitness, riding bikes, Ironman, all that stuff.
It's just mind-boggling and so inspirational. But how long were you in treatment?
A month, yeah.
Oh, just 1 month?
1 month.
Okay.
Yep, that was enough for me. And I want to, you know, be mindful and respectful that that's not always the case for people.
Right.
I had a very unique set of circumstances. I certainly was addicted and could have gone down the path. Had attention toward the opioid epidemic started back then, and you know the drugs were withheld from me.
Yeah.
There's a strong likelihood that I would have gone to street drugs, heroin, cocaine, things like that to nurse my discomfort. But luckily, never got that far. But I know that that's a common tale where people fall down into the pit of despair, and you know, alcohol or drugs are there to lift them back up. Mm-hmm. It's also why I'm such a big proponent of cannabis and other holistic remedies like acupuncture, massage, PT, Reiki, any of those holistic, mindful wellness activities. I'm all in support for it because I don't want people to go first to pharmaceuticals and go down the path that I went down. Right. That said, yeah, having the idea that life was possible after cancer was huge. It was pivotal for me to come back to life.
That's so amazing. Yeah. So you just were like, hey, I'm better now. Let's go do an Ironman.
Yeah, somewhat.
Let's talk about
you know,
that.
I feel like I peaked too soon because now social media is such like woven into the fabric of our lives. Back then, Facebook and Instagram were really growing in popularity, 2009, 2010. And Austin was as well. So more and more people were moving here by the day. I was working at Costco wholesale, pushing carts. And, you know, I write about all this in the book. So if you're listening at home, it's a good story.
That is a good story. I agree.
But I had to start somewhere. So I was pushing carts at Costco. You know, after 90 days of probation, you prove you can do the work. I moved to a cashier and ran into a lot of people that I'd either known from my younger years or met new people with this new vibrant attitude that I had. I was just always smiling. Like, I wasn't in a hospital bed. I wasn't addicted to drugs. I wasn't in jail. I'm happy. I'm not in the places that I was before.
Right.
And the kind of like tipping point for me getting back into fitness was through Team and Training. It's a program by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society that allows individuals to raise money for an endurance event, whether it be a marathon, a hike, an Ironman, or a bike ride.
Okay.
And in return, you get coaching, like professional coaching and a exercise, a fitness plan. And all the money that you raise goes to, you know, support cancer, blood cancer endeavors, whether it's research, whether it's patient support, whether it's grants, a lot of the practical needs that patients go through are now a focus.
Okay.
And my dad had done a century bike ride with Team and Training in 1998. And I was 13 years old and I had spoken at the inspiration dinner. And I remember I had walked around the Town Lake Trail one day and the only like sleeveless cutoff shirt that I had that summer was a Team and Training shirt. And I put it on and I'm like, you know what? I think I'm going to reach out to Team and Training and see, is it still around? Are they still doing these bike rides? I literally cold called the office, local office of Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and Maggie Caldwell, a longtime dear friend now, was the campaign manager for the cycle program.
Okay.
She was like, I'd love for you to be our honored teammate. You come on out. We're going to Tahoe to ride in Tahoe this year. So
that
I'm like,
stink.
Twist my arm, please. Yeah. And I reached out to my bone marrow donor, Steve, and I said, hey, why don't we do a bike ride together? And he's like, I'm there. I'm in. So he raised money through the Illinois chapter. I raised money through Austin. We met in Tahoe. I was nominated again to speak at the Inspiration Dinner. So we're at this, you know, banquet hall in a resort and casino. And I remember distinctly being told, you know, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra had performed here. And I'm like, well, it just makes sense that Mike Thompson would follow suit. headliners here.
The first time you did this, you were 13.
I was 13 in Tucson.
Okay.
And here I am again, probably. So this was 2009. So I was 24 at the time. And I remember being this, like, you know, still this young kid. I was the exact same height that I was when I was 13. But I had, you know, great jokes, a little bit more awareness of public speaking. And what really resonated with me was after I did that talk, standing ovation, I'm walking back to our team table. We had 32 people from Austin come out with us, and then Steve, my donor. And I remember one of my best friends, Alan Benton, was there with his wife, Kristen, and, you know, 30 other people that were just part of our training as we went through the whole season together. And I remember walking back to the table. I'm like, this is my life now. Like, this is, I can do this.
Yep.
And countless people came up to me afterwards and they said, you know, every team and training event that I've done in recent years has always had the survivor of someone that's passed away give the talk, give the mission moment.
Okay.
And it was so great to see that the work that we're doing is working for someone like you. You are still alive because of these efforts that we're contributing towards team and training and philanthropic efforts for Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. So we rode in Tahoe the next day. It was a bright, sunshiny day. I think it got up to like 80. And, you know, the emerald and azure waters of the lake were, you know, our backdrop for the entire ride around. And we get back that night and I am renewed. I am just like, what more can I do here? Got recruited to join the triathlon team. You know, a few months later, there was a half Ironman in Galveston that was happening. I'm like, well, I know I can ride a bike. I just started running again, but like I have diminished lung capacity and I've never swam competitively before. And they're like, we'll train you. You'll have a coach. So signed up for a triathlon. At this point, Mike, I think it's important to note that the grief that I had felt saying goodbye to my former self was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I now was like, I can compete in cycling. I can go fast. I'm not competing against other people. I'm competing against myself.
Yeah.
And I'm proving to myself that even though doctors said I wouldn't be able to walk without pain in my leg, much less run, I'm out here doing century bike rides and I'm running marathons. And I'm showcasing that, you know, just because the odds are stacked against you, doesn't mean you have to follow those odds.
Sure. Do you feel like the physical activity and the fitness and all that sort of stuff, do you feel like that was a big part of being able to shed some of that grief?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Because, and I firmly believe this, because now I have to do something active every day. And I feel like it adds longevity to our life if you're fit. I feel like it is a sustainable source of energy that you can renew every day just by being active. And truly, you know, you can talk about the chemical aspect of it. You know, I was taking drugs to mask the pain in my brain.
Right.
Well, the endorphins and the adrenaline that came from riding bikes, running, swimming, replaced that need.
Yep.
So even though I was free of the drugs after that, there was still this yearn for comfort somewhere.
Sure.
From atrophy of my muscles, from psychological pain, and being fit brought me back to life. And to go from being told I wouldn't run ever again to training for a half Ironman in Galveston was this bookended journey of like, wow, I was here and now I'm here. I'm never going to complain ever again. And that's when I started saying to myself, I'm going to find the good in every situation.
Okay.
So crushed the half Ironman in Galveston, immediately signed up for the inaugural Ironman Texas in the Woodlands, which was 2011. At that point, I went from working at Costco to working for one of my best friends, Jack Murray, at Jack and Adams Bicycles. Start selling bikes, start training every day for Ironman. May of 2011, I go and I race Ironman Texas. The entire time that I'm there, I am envisioning the stories of Dick and Rick Hoyt, this father-son duo. Dick was the dad. Ricky had cerebral palsy. And when Rick was young, they told him, you need to commit him to an institution. Mm. He's going to need around-the-clock care. He's not going to live a good life. And Dick refused to believe that. They got him a mobile wheelchair. They got him a computer that helped him talk. They invested in making Rick's life as livable as possible, despite being born with a debilitating condition.
Right.
And so in order to give Rick that experience of fitness and exercise, he started pushing him in a cart and doing local 5Ks. Then it went to 10Ks. Then it went to marathons and eventually the Ironman. So I remember watching those hype videos thinking to myself, I have autonomy. I have freedom. I'm not addicted to drugs anymore. I'm not shackled to a hospital bed or an IV pole. I will do this in honor of Rick. I will do this in honor and in memory of everyone that I've ever lost. I will not complain. I am going to focus on these physical endeavors because it's what fulfills me and makes me positively selfish. But I'm going to surround myself with people that are doing the same. And most importantly, I'm going to affect positive change in the world through these endeavors. And so when I finished Ironman Texas, it was both a feat that I never thought was possible for my own performance, but it was also a symbol of I should be dead right now for multiple reasons. Mm-hmm. I'm still alive and I'm accomplishing great feats. And I'm only able to do that because of the people that I've surrounded myself with. I'm going to start telling this story because I believe you don't have to have cancer. You don't have to have been a drug addict to appreciate life in a very profound way. So I'm going to start sharing this story with everyone. That led to the dream of racing Ironman Kona, the world championship. Ironman Foundation released a campaign called Anything is Possible, Kona Inspired. And it had looked for compelling stories of people that had used triathlon to return to life. Mm-hmm. And so the cohort that I came with, there were six of us that won the contest originally. One was racing for orphans with Down syndrome. One was overcoming an eating disorder. Others were cancer survivors, MS survivors. And we all had unique and compelling stories, but we were all there to prove anything is possible through triathlon.
Right.
And more than 250,000 people voted for my story to win the whole thing.
Wow.
So I got an all-expenses-paid trip to the Ironman World Championship in Hawaii, October of 2012, and I crushed it. I mean, I wasn't setting any records by any means, but I knew I wanted to swim decent. I'm a horrible swimmer. I wanted to bike my ass off, and then I wanted to be able to run and throw down a really good marathon time. So I came in at 12 hours, 50 minutes, respectable time for the conditions that were out there. But more than anything, crossing that finish line on Elite E Drive, again, was something that was just so far off in the realm of impossibility for me that moment marked my, you know, if I do nothing else in life, I've accomplished this. I am an Ironman world champion, and I should be dead.
If I remember right, in the book, didn't one of your friends climb into the announcer's booth?
So for anybody that's done an Ironman, hearing Mike Riley, the voice of Ironman, say, "You are an Ironman," that, like, I'm getting chills just thinking about it right now.
Yeah.
My friend and roommate, Rachel, at the time, knew Mike Riley well, and she had gotten her way into the announcer booth. So as I'm running down the last 100 yards into the finisher's chute, I'm literally taking a mental picture of this finish line because I never want to forget this moment.
Yep.
I hear, "Ladies and gentlemen, he's a four-time cancer survivor. He is Kona inspired. Mike Thompson, you are an Ironman, and your roommate up here loves you."
That's awesome.
And it was just one of those moments where it was going to be magical no matter what, hearing that. But the fact that I had kind of a personal acknowledgement, that is an indelible moment in my life.
It will be cemented.
Yes, big time. And you know, the rest of the week was spent with Jack and my friend Ashley and Corey and my family, just enjoying Hawaii. And it was a really pivotal moment for me. But I came back from that, you know, energized and thinking, what more can I do to affect positive change in this world? And that truly is when the book idea started.
Yep. And so what was the process of, you know, how long did it take and, you know, all that sort of stuff to put a book together?
Yeah. You know, so I'll say back then is when I started really thinking about it, of chronicling this whole story. And part of that was motivated by convenience. You know, I wanted to be able to say, I don't have time. I don't have 2 hours to walk you through everything I've been through. Take this, read it, and get back to me, and we'll have a conversation.
Yep.
The other thing is to give it to people that are enduring cancer or addiction or the loss of a family member or their own depression. And I think in this life, we're so focused on, as we should be, you know, human beings are always surrounded by other human beings. That's what creates meaning in life. And I wasn't sure that I had the ability to convey the symbols, the knowledge, the wisdom, the experience that I had in the book until I returned to school. So for me, the start of the book really came with the decision to return to school. I had left college my first year after complications with this happened in 2003 and didn't go back, had really no desire to go back to school. Part of that was because I had to take Vicodin before every class and could barely remember what I was learning.
Right.
So I'm working for Livestrong Foundation, 2016-17, and I see this ad pop up for Concordia University Online. My old school had a fully online integrated program with professors. So I didn't want to go to University of Phoenix and kind of go at your own pace. Like, I wanted a legitimate bachelor's degree. And Concordia, I was already a student. I was still on medical withdrawal from 2003.
Wow.
So while I wouldn't necessarily recommend 13 years as a proper hiatus from academics,
right.
It worked great for me because I was eager and ready to learn. And so I got in, finished my bachelor's in 3.5 years. That coincided with COVID. Decided at that point I'm going to keep going down the academic route. I apply to and get accepted at Texas State University for a master's program in communication. And getting my bachelor's was more of a check off the bucket list for me of saying, like, I have this degree now. But it was the process of getting through school that I really wanted. I wanted to say that I stayed the course throughout all of my courses and earned that degree. The communication, master's degree in communication side was like, let's see what this does. This isn't mastering communication of like, how many emails do you send out, or you know, what's the data behind social media, and like, how are you communicating with your audience and your customers? No, it was identifying what communication is rooted in, which my argument was persuasion, and then looking at like how social movements have happened in the past. How did we get from Nazi Germany to civil rights in the U.S.? How did we get from, you know, even now, the war on drugs with first starting in the 30s to Nixon to Reagan to now finally understanding what cannabis can do. You know, all these things are rooted in communication. And I feel like I have the means to share a story that's compelling to get people to live their best life. But I want to truly understand the nuances of how to do that.
Okay.
And that's what the master's program was. So while the book idea started in kind of 2012, 2013 with Kona, I then joined Livestrong and climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in 2015. So that was just another thing to put in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to wait until I truly felt capable of putting in here tools and resources and a valuable lesson for anyone. Again, not just cancer patients, not addicts, not people who had lost others, but anyone in life from any background, any age, any industry, any race, any religion. You can apply the tenets of finding good to your life and live a prosperous one. And for me, getting that master's degree was that stamp, that seal of approval that, like, I am ready to push this out.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was finishing grad school, I really started to put pen to paper. And I did it in a chronological way, because just like we've discussed today, you have to understand the origin of how I got here.
Right.
Being a 10-year-old kid and told that you're going to die, to being 39 years old, having a best-selling published book, talking to one of my best friends on a podcast not long after his son was taken too soon. The importance of this right now, more than ever, is not lost on me. And sharing stories of grief, stories of trauma, but giving people the ability to find triumph is my ultimate goal now.
That's great. And it's one of my favorite things about the book is it's not just a story. It's, I mean, there are digestible pieces of, you know, here's what I did and here's how it positively affected things or changed the trajectory of my life. Well done, man.
Thank you. It was a passion project for sure. I had a lot of help on it. Cindy, my editor and publisher, helped out a lot. My friend Will Bryant helped design the front of the cover, and I wanted it to be this kind of whimsical, joyous look where you're in the airport, you see this, you're like, Finding Good. I want to read that.
Yeah.
Like, I want to find good. So he did a great job on it. And then Alan, you know, one of my best friends, invested a lot of time, money, guidance into, you know, turning this into a business. Because while money is not a factor for me always, I'm not very money driven.
Right.
I'm impact driven. And I know that I need to earn money so that I can be a vehicle for, you know, supporting other causes. So that is a tertiary goal of this. But the first two are 100% give this to somebody who needs a little bit of inspiration in life.
Mm-hmm.
And then two is providing the resources to get to the point where I am. So in concert, working together, these three tenets have been monumental in my life. And I feel like I lay a pathway for everyone else to do it too.
So go ahead and outline the three tenets.
So first and foremost, we have to be positively selfish. And this is up to the individual to define that. So for me, being positively selfish means 100% I have to be active outside. I struggle mentally if I'm not fit and active and doing something in our natural environment.
Okay.
I also am a foodie. I have to have good food. Kendall, my wife, makes fun of me all the time because she can be fine with just like vermicelli noodles and butter.
Right.
I'm making my own pasta. I'm, you know, growing my, you know, she's an incredible green thumb and we have an amazing garden. So I'm out getting the tomatoes and, you know, sauteing them, making my own marinara sauce, hand rolling pasta. It's 2.5 hours after I started that I finally get to eat, where she's in bed sleeping. But I'm very, very food motivated and I love surrounding myself with people that are food motivated. So those things, you know, being active, eating good food, and then selfishly being around people also gives me that motivation. So being positively selfish is making yourself as whole as possible, but it's also making sure that you're not being negatively selfish to others, commandeering their time, bringing people down. So there's a little bit of a tapestry written in the book that helps people identify that. The second tenet.
So doing things, if I can summarize, just in my layman terms, basically doing things for yourself, but not at the expense of others.
Take care of 100%.
Okay. Perfect.
I need to edit the book and put that in there. But take care of your mind and body first so you can take care of others second.
There you go.
Is a perfect way to summarize it.
Okay.
Leading into the second tenet, which is surround yourself with good people. This is just as important as getting rid of bad people as it is identifying good ones.
Yeah.
But also, I call it curating a cloud of influence. You can realistically only have a handful of very profound, deep relationships. That's just based on bandwidth of time.
Sure.
Unless it is your job and you don't have to worry about money. I was listening to a guy that I love following, Professor Scott Galloway, and he was talking about young people right now. They want to get rich quick, but they're kind of not really in willing and ready to put in the work to do that. It takes time to curate a cloud of influence. It takes time to build a business. Relationship should be a form of value and not something that detracts value. So identifying those key people, you're one of them for me. You know, you're my North Star of like, what's it like to be an entrepreneur, a business owner, a husband, for me, a dog dad, a human dad. But identifying those people, my friend Alan, my friend Jack Murray, Reina Vasquez of Veracruz, Kendra Scott, you know, like all these people that are from Austin, hardworking. I want to emulate them and I want to keep them close. Mm-hmm. So curate the cloud of influence second. And then the third one for me is non-negotiable, is leave the world better than you found it. So if you are being positively selfish, meaning you're whole, and you're surrounding yourself with people that are doing the same, it should be easy for you to affect positive change in the world. So together, through information, knowledge, money, resources, all of these things can influence society for the better. And I call it pro-social endeavors. So anytime an athlete, you know, take Tom Brady, the GOAT, gives back, it makes me like that person that much more. Mm. Not everyone is obligated to to do things. You know, LeBron James could easily just live his life as a billionaire, basketball player, all-star, but he invests in, you know, schools in Cleveland and continues to give back. And I think for me, that is, like I said before, a sustainable source of energy to give back and to help others. And for me, it's a tenet that I think rounds out the first two perfectly, because while we're here on this earth, we know it's limited. You of all people know this. And if I'm lucky, I will have lived around 80 years, 80 summers. I've got 41 left, if we go by that.
Yeah.
I mean, count anything. I've got, you know, put out 40 marbles right here. You take one away, all of a sudden, you're like, oh, well, I want that back. Yeah. Like, I don't want to let these go, but time is going to keep moving forward. So what are we doing with that time while we're here? Be positively selfish, surround yourself with good people, and do your part to leave the world better than you found it. Regardless of religion, spirituality, worldview, ideology, those are three easily accessible tenets that anybody can do. And I promise you, it gives you purpose and meaning beyond compare.
Yeah, that's powerful, man. You know, it's funny. You said, you know, I got 40 more years. I read something probably like a year or so ago, and they were talking about, you know, having aging parents, right? And they were like, you know, say your dad is, or your mom is 70 years old, and they're going to live on an average to 85.
Right.
Technically, you have 15 years to see them.
Yeah.
But if you only see them twice a year, you got 30 visits.
Count them down.
That's crazy.
They're going to go quick.
15 years and 30 visits are two very, very, very different things.
But,
yeah.
But I think we have mental shortcuts in our minds where we're like, well, I'm going to, you know, my mom's hopefully going to live for another 30 years. She's in her 60s, right?
Yeah.
But how often am I seeing her down in Seguin?
Yeah.
Or how often am I, for instance, my Aunt Carolyn, you know, she passed a little over a week ago. I was in Marfa on a trip with my beloved Breakfast Club community.
Yep.
Wouldn't have changed anything. And her health had been ailing for a while. She passed the day before my birthday. I didn't have any regrets. I'd gotten to see her and Uncle Steve over the past few years, usually, you know, once every couple of months, and we caught up and spent quality time.
Good.
Both of my grandparents on my mom's side passed away within the last couple of years, so I knew that others were going to follow. We know that by time, we're going to start saying goodbye to people during this physical time on Earth. But yeah, I mean, the 15 years sounds like a lot, but when you look at it your way, 30 visits is going to count down much faster.
Yeah.
And the reason why I emphasize surrounding yourself with good people is we can exhaust ourselves trying to keep up with all the different relationships and encounters that we have in life. But focusing on the ones that bring you value, the ones that you know are sustainable, and that, you know, people that would give you the shirt off their back if you needed it.
Yeah.
Curating that cloud of influence can make sure that those 15 years or those 30 visits are meaningful.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I obviously haven't met everybody in your circle. You run in a very, you run in a circle of very special people, the ones that I've met for sure.
Big time.
So the fact that you would even consider including me in that, man, I'm super honored.
Well, we have 10 years together. And, you know, that first time when I came to Cuvée, I've always had this, and it could be just my curiosity, which I also talk about in the book. You know, we've got to stay curious. Ted Lasso did a Jason Sudeikis and that team. I write about it in the book, like such a powerful show because it is so positive.
Yeah.
And, you know, the one scene when he's about to play Rupert in darts, he said, I saw a poem by Walt Whitman and say, you know, stay curious, not judgmental.
Okay.
And so I titled the chapter Be Curious, Not Judgmental, because being curious means that you have this altruistic view of like, I genuinely want to know your story. I genuinely want to know why Cuvée, what you do. I hope everybody knows that you go to Brazil, that you go to Colombia, that you are literally sourcing the beans and meeting the farmers to create this product that is celebrated by a lot of people. It helped that Cuvée is the same color blue as the book.
That was one of the first things I noticed.
My favorite color.
Great.
And you know, my truck's the same color as that. It's incredible. But that drew me in immediately because I love the color blue. Then I learned the story of it, and then I learned your passion. And that's why to this day, you know, we had Cuvée cold brew on the mountain. You know, open up that can, your patented nitrogen release for the nitro cold brew. I've been taking that stuff since 2014.
Yeah.
So meeting the man behind it back then, learning your story, and then knowing that you're a veteran, knowing that you're a dad, knowing you're a husband, knowing you're a business owner, knowing that you are an individual that every time I leave you, I feel like I learn something or gain value in some way.
That's awesome.
And so I started wanting to emulate that. And Kendall, my wife, it's a joke from comedian John Mulaney, but she always says, like, I'm running for the mayor of nowhere. I just, you know, want to meet people and talk to them and shake hands and kiss babies and do all that. But it's just because of the stark difference of being in a hospital bed, being under the spell of addiction, and now not.
Yeah.
And so this is a vibrant, sustainable force of energy that I now have because of the energy that I kind of steal from others. And so you are 100% at the top of that list. You got there early and you stayed there.
Thanks, man. Well, I will say you radiate way more positive energy than you're taking from other people. There's no doubt. Like, there is not a moment that I spend with you where I don't walk away, you know, and just to kind of steal your words and feel like I just had one of the most meaningful interactions of my life. So
that means a lot coming from you.
Yeah. So thank you for that. Thank you for sharing this story, and not just the story, but, you know, all the just, you know, good, bad, and ugly, that you had to endure, the people that helped you get through it, you know, like your mom and, you know, like your friends, you know, who were there when you needed a job and when you know, that sort of stuff. And then just your drive and your motivation and your discipline it's amazing. It's really inspiring.
And again, I want to acknowledge what you've done with BPOS, because unfortunately I've known hundreds of kids that have succumbed to cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it has nothing to do with they didn't pray enough. They didn't engage in the treatment. It's just life happens and it hurts sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I will never, ever, ever judge a family who's lost, especially a child, but a loved one too soon, that, you know, just kind of lives their life in peace and quiet from that point forward. On the other hand, and I'm thinking about my friends, the Wilkes family. After their daughter Jennifer passed away, they started the Jennifer Wilkes Foundation. And every year they have this amazing golf tournament at Star Ranch, and they, you know, donate, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to different causes.
That's awesome.
In her memory.
Yeah.
And when I learned about Connor, you know, my first instinct was, you know, something pilot, combat, you know, military related.
Right.
And to have him taken from us in such a painful and traumatic way, I could have easily understood if you and Rochelle and Cole picked up the pieces and moved somewhere else, or rearranged your life so that the pain of losing Connor was not front and center all the time, or not a constant reminder. But instead, you've got BPOS. And instead, you are now on the verge of reaching potentially millions of people by addressing grief, by acknowledging that life can have some very painful moments, But if you be pause, if you live the way that Connor did in his short life, I guarantee you, you're going to live a good one.
Yeah.
And on your last days, whether you, you know, passed away suddenly and painlessly, or you're enduring, you know, an end of life disease or challenge, but you're very aware of your mortality, which I am every day.
Yeah.
You will have no regrets if you live like Connor and if you be positive yeah. and if you find the good.
Yeah. Well said. Mikey, thanks again, man. I really enjoyed this.
Me too, my friend.
Looking forward to the next coffee and taco get together.
I think the sky's the limit for you, and I'm excited to see where this goes and how many lives it touches.
Oh, before we go, on that note,
yeah,
you've got a podcast that you're putting together now, right?
Yeah, the Finding Good podcast. I literally did one episode just right out of the gate with one of my best friends who's enduring her cancer battle right now. Her name is Rachel.
Wow.
And no frills about it. No music, no ads, no nothing. It's just her and I having a conversation.
Yep.
But you can access it from my website and from my Instagram. So if any listeners are curious as to what we're talking about with Finding Good, Mr. McKim is going to be on in the next few months. But it really is just about, you know, showcasing and telling stories of how people have found the good in their life, overcome obstacles and challenges, learn to be positively selfish, curated a cloud of influence, and then they are giving back to the world in myriad ways. So the Finding Good podcast is in its infancy, but I hope to match your growth and impact on the world.
All great podcasts got to start somewhere.
That's it, man.
Yeah, and I expect very big things.
Yeah, same yeah. for you.
Your track record is pretty impressive. So.
Yours as well.
Yeah. I'll be learning from you about podcasts in the very near future, I'm sure.
We'll grow together. How's
All
that?
All right, I love it. Yeah. All right, Mikey. Thanks, man. I love you, buddy.
Love you too, Mike.
Take care. Yeah.